Hello, and welcome to episode 89 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Shuffler. Before I get to this week's episode, I want to repeat the exciting announcement from last week. Planning Period Podcast is participating in its first ever in-person meetup. I will be joining up with Chris Nessie, Stacey Lindez, AJ Bianco, and other education podcasters at ISTE 2019 in Philly. The meetup will be on Sunday, June 23rd at 6 p.m. at Pat's King of Steaks. We'll do the Pat's versus Geno's challenge, which means we'll have a cheesesteak at Pat's and then at Geno's, and we'll see which one is better. So if you'd like to meet me and other education podcasters, and you'll be in Philly on Sunday, June 23rd, join us at 6 p.m. at Pat's King of Steaks. This week on the show, I am joined by Brad Gustafson. Brad is an elementary school principal, a former second grade teacher. He is also the author of a new book, Reclaiming Our Calling, Hold On to the Heart, Mind, and Hope of Education. I know him from Twitter. I've been following him there for a while, and I was really excited to get him on the show. Brad and I talk about what both our roles are like, the importance of passion in education and how to cultivate it, how we are more connected than we realize, even across states, the problems with varied versions of personalization, the balance of needs for testing and needs for lifelong learning, and how teachers need to show that they care for their students. So, sit back and enjoy episode 89 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dr. Brad Gustafson. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Shuffler, and I am joined today by principal and fellow podcaster and all kinds of cool stuff, Dr. Brad Gustafson. You know, we started so quick, I didn't even ask if I was going to say your name right. Now I feel like a complete unprofessional.
The thing that you dropped the ball on the intro, because the coolest fact here is we got the double Bradage going on.
We got Brad, the Brad show.
I'm Brad, and that's all that matters.
We got the Brad show. I feel like we could run a podcast together either about education or crafts.
Exactly. We could analyze different types of Brads or nails.
I like it. That'd
be really exciting, right?
I think everybody would love that show. And in fact, I think it's time for a pivot change on the
podcast. I don't even know if I could get my mom to listen to that one. But
well, Brad, first of all, thank you for joining me on the show. I really appreciate it. And for my audience who do not know you, could you give me a little bit of an introduction to who you are?
I would love to. So I started my career in education as a second grade teacher and totally adored that work. And now I'm serving as an elementary principal in Minnesota. And I recently wrote a book called Reclaiming Our Calling, Hold On to the Heart, Mind, and Hope of Education. So that's it in a nutshell.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. Well, let's start with elementary principal. How do you like that? That's a really weak question, but I'm going to go with it anyways.
Sure. No, hey, no problem. And then I'd be curious because the thing that drew me to your show, Brad, I love the format. I listen to a lot of podcasts that have tighter focus and they're great, but this is just a little bit different than I'm used to. So I love, it's almost kind of like running into you in the lounge from, 3,000 miles away, but here we are.
Works out.
Yeah, but I really love it. I mean, I don't know how it works at other levels for teachers and administrators, but I would assume they probably resonate with kids in a different way, same but different. But for me, it's so, so cool and inspiring just to see kids. I mean, honestly, some days start with kids skipping down the hall. Can you picture a kindergartner just kind of skipping, not a care in the world and just loving life? Today, this morning, we open our doors at a certain time and we had, 15 kids, ranging probably from first grade to fourth grade out front doing a countdown. One of them had the universal watch. So they had they were on to our school time and they were just excited to come in counting down from 20. I mean, I'm just sitting there chuckling. Like I was impressed that their time skills were spot on, but the fact that they were kind of almost beating down the door in joy to get in. So that encapsulates the work of an elementary principal. It's amazing. And I don't know if middle schoolers, maybe they do that too, but I guess when I was in middle school, I was looking at the clock to leave.
They would do the other way around. I don't know that my middle schoolers get excited to jump into school every day. Although they still manage to weasel their way into the courtyard before we want them to every morning. They just don't want to weasel their way into classes early.
Right. So we didn't even connect on that level yet. You're a middle school teacher?
I am. Well, I'm an instructional coach. school instructional coach. So nice. I do a little bit of everything in that role. And then as listeners of the show, I know I'm currently in my ed leadership program to start getting my way into admin, much against my will. and my father is a recently retired elementary principal. So, you know, we got all that.
So what do you mean,
all the connections?
What do you mean against your will? What does that mean?
I never wanted to go into leadership. Admin, it's never been my goal. I love coaching. I love supporting teachers. I love supporting students in that role. Yep. And, when I switched schools, my admin at my school now were very insistent, and, starting my master's program sort of became the path of least resistance in a lot of ways. And, as it was explained to me, when someone has the capacity and I look around and can see that there are plenty of people in admin roles who don't have the capacity to do the job, it is a dereliction of duty to not do it. Yep. And that was some harsh words, and I didn't find a way to argue with them. So. Sure.
So our journey sounds somewhat similar, because when I was teaching second grade, I never envisioned or aspired to do anything else. And still, some of my best memories of education are from that classroom. But I did have a principal come in one day, and she handed me a brochure from a university and just said, I think you should do this. I think you'd be good at that. And in my naivete or fragileness of being a newer teacher, I kind of internally thought, am I doing a bad job? Because I was loving the work. Like, is she trying to get rid of me? But I don't think she was trying to get rid of me. I think she actually saw some things in me that I didn't see stirring in myself. So I signed up for the program kind of sort of reluctantly, at least, or should I say not planning to go into administration. But I honestly just love learning. So I took the classes and just soaked them in. And that was kind of my hobby. And even after that degree, that's just what I love doing. But the more that I learned, the more I thought, hey, you know, some of the things that I love most about teaching second grade, I can still keep those connections and in just a different way. And some of the character education stuff, like maybe I could collaborate with people on a different level, or maybe even with more people, and they might be interested. And so that's kind of how that evolved.
That's cool. So how does that lead into your book and the writing of your book, which is, you know, one of those endeavors that I always thought I will maybe do one day and have never done and probably won't.
I think it does, but do you mind if I just, I have a little bit of like self-diagnosed ADD. So I got to ask you a quick question before we go on. Otherwise it'll just evaporate and it'll be gone. When you talk about your role as an instructional coach, there aren't a ton of people who do what you do, or, you know, there's relative to classroom teachers, there are fewer principals and instructional coaches, right? So when I visit classrooms, I'm assuming it's kind of similar, but I'll go into a room and be just floored at like the difference and the cool, just the deeper work that's happening, to the point where sometimes I'm doing kind of fist pumps, or maybe it's internal, but I'm just leaving thinking, God, we need more people to see this because it's so awesome. And just, I get to bounce around from class to class and see that and have conversations like that. So I'm just curious, kind of, is your experience similar to that, or do you not get to visit a bunch of rooms and learn from a bunch of people?
Oh, I'm in rooms a lot. It's, but it's a kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. When you have, we have 170 teachers at our school. And so you have to kind of prioritize and figure out the right places to be. And we also, to be fair, have a large coaching staff. We have, I think, 5 instructional coaches that have different specialities. But even still, we kind of, this year, we sort of ranked our teachers sort of on proficiency and who had the most needs. And so I spent a lot more time in classes that had a lot more needs and a lot more growth potential, we'll put it that way. And so that can be really taxing when you are in rooms where you're not seeing positive things. And so we started instituting kind of an unspoken rule of sorts, where we said, okay, if we're going to go into 3 rooms who need a lot of support, we're going to force ourselves to go into an awesome room just to remind us that that's happening.
Sure. Sure.
Because, you know, but don't get me wrong. Absolutely. Those are those moments where you're in just an awesome classroom, and then you're supposed to give some kind of constructive feedback. And it's just like, you know what? You're great. I don't, honestly, just keep doing what you're doing. I don't have anything to add. Just, you're doing it great. Keep that.
I know it's pretty humbling when you're just sitting watching someone do their craft so well. And I try to force myself to somehow add value. And sometimes it's just through asking questions, like, help me understand the why behind what you're doing, because it is amazing and the result is so good. But tell me about what you're thinking so I can learn from it. So you answered another follow-up I had, because as you're coaching and trying to support people in their growth, I would assume you would want people to really welcome you with open arms and just have it be a nice, trusting relationship. So do people invite you in? It's not necessarily just kind of self-diagnose where you're identifying need. I would assume there are just lots of voracious learners who are saying, hey, I'd like to learn about this, regardless of whether they quote unquote need the extra help. Does that happen? Or
we have some, absolutely. I run an appointment calendar so my staff can book me anytime they want, and we have some that will book me regularly despite the fact they don't need me. You know, just come in and talk to me about something. And we also will run a lot of optional, like, planning period mini PDs, kind of just short little sessions on specific tools or specific strategies. And you know, there's always those people that come to every single one, even though they probably don't need it.
they could be teaching it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they still want to come in and ask questions and hang out. And so, yeah, we definitely get some of those for sure.
Huh, that's cool. Okay, thanks for satisfying that curiosity of mine.
No, absolutely.
It's good to kind of know who I'm learning from today.
I like it. Well, the goal of the show is to learn from you. I already know what I think.
Okay, well, I'll do the best I can to help there.
So tell me about the book. What's the situation there?
Yeah. So I think the overarching thing is the book is about relationships, but it's not just like the banner saying relationships are important, because most people or educators who have a similar belief system than I do understand the deep importance of it. So I always tell people the book is not for everything, because sometimes I get pushback on Twitter it seems like at the high school level more often than not. I'm not painting everyone with that broad brush, but I've just noticed that as far as prioritization of content, that's where the pushback comes, where, and I'm not talking about every day, but just every once in a while. So if you're someone who thinks that, like, leading with content first and accountability first is like your mission or your sole job, this book probably won't resonate. If you're someone who believes that, like, relationships matter so deeply, and that when you relate to someone and when you know them and when you continue to invest in that and they invest in you, that you can actually go further, that's who the book is intended, who it's written for. So there's a important distinction there. So within that relational lens, it's also a book that, like, reclaiming our calling, inherent in the title is the fact that this isn't just a job that we signed up for, like, as a principal now, why I get up in the morning and then why I signed on as a second grade teacher. I want kids to achieve at a really high level, but there's so much more than that. And a lot of people that I talk to, they believe that in their heart, regardless of the system or state they're working in. I mean, sometimes there are barriers and policies set up where it kind of skews the balance, where it makes a score or a school designation more important, or at least sometimes it can feel that way to the heart work that we're doing, like raising young men and women and boys and girls to be great people and thinkers and have empathy and include one another. I mean, all of those things matter, and so does achievement. So the whole book isn't written to bash testing by any means, but it's to say, I think we need to do both. And I think we also need to help one another on how that can happen. Because right now it can feel pretty overwhelming, especially if you're not in a super supportive system.
Yeah, I think that's really critical. I mean, and like you said, I think especially the overwhelming component, there is so much for a teacher to do, and it can feel tremendously overwhelming on a day-by-day basis. And you're right, the supportive system, I think, is so critical.
Right. I mean, and then when you look at other conversations that are happening, right, like literally right now, about, you know, should teachers be armed in schools? And my intent in mentioning this isn't to politicize anything, because I'm just saying we have a lot to worry about, like, when we're talking about learning and assessment and building relationships and keeping kids safe. But to start piling on additional responsibilities and then have educators have to really worry on a deep level about things like that may have less to do with the work that they're tasked with and communicating with parents. I mean, it's a big platter or plate, you know, that's already full. And then people, I feel like, are probably constantly trying to fill it with more. Or here's what I feel, and I'd be curious to know your thoughts on this. I hear a lot of people diminishing the work that's already being done that we know or feel is central. And I think relationships are one part, but another part of reclaiming our calling is having educators not have to justify innovation or creativity or you know, investing in a kiddo just for a passion that they have or that, that you want to develop in them. I always kind of look at kids that we have about 813 kids in our school this year. And, you know, as they're walking through the halls and sitting in their tables and groups, you know, really the next, and I'll just make up names, but the next Mia Hamm, the next Maya Angelou, they're sitting in our desks, right? The future of the world is there, and they have immense talents and passions. And if we're not totally committed to unearthing and cultivating those along with the core content that, that we're responsible for helping them with, we're, the world really misses out. And the same would be true for the educators, I think, as well. Like if people have to kind of check their identity at the door and their skill set and passion to kind of conform into being an educator that maybe politicians are expecting them to be, you know, we can't be in the business of pleasing everyone in the world. I mean, that's a call. That's not why I'm called. I'm called really to see kids for who they are and who they can be, and then work with my colleagues to help get them there while also kind of investing my passions into it. But I was, that's a, you got me a little bit fired up. If you
good.
Can tell.
That's how, perfect.
How's the, how are you feeling? And is there a tension in Florida kind of with some of the achievement and other extraneous expectations?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a tension between what, I mean, I think generally speaking, there's a tension between what legislators want and mm-hmm. what a teacher wants. And that, I think, is kind of a general disconnect, because legislators rarely understand what is actually going on in education, and educators don't necessarily understand what's going on in legislation. And so I think there's a lack of connection in both directions. And it's hard, you know, that it's hard to feel like you're going about your day as a teacher and doing the best you can and doing the right things for your kids, but that may not be directly tied to a standard that's on a state assessment at the end of the year, right? Like, I mean, we're in the middle of our standardized testing month, literally almost every single day for the last 3 weeks. And all again, next week, we have some form of standardized testing going on our campus. Mm-hmm. And it's been insane. And it's been nonstop for the coaches and the support people to just help facilitate that and organize it and keep it running, which means we're not in classrooms supporting teachers. And mm-hmm. it's all to get state scores and make sure we reach certification and funding and everything else, which mm-hmm. shouldn't really be what we're spending our days doing. It's not the thing that's best affecting students or best able to impact students. And yet if we don't do it, we don't have the money to keep teaching students at all. So you have mm-hmm. to do it. And it does impact students, but it shouldn't be a thing we have to do to impact students, right? Like that's the, mm-hmm. I think that's where it's at.
One of the things in the book, it's actually a pretty big theme. It's, no, you know, no educator I've ever talked to is against meaningful assessment. We believe in meaningful and effective assessment. We just don't believe in destructive testing practices and things that actually are harmful to kids or that kind of usurp or don't support the work we're doing. So if it can be meaningful, we are all in. The hard part for me and for other educators, I think, and I don't see my position as one speaking for other people, so I guess I'll just speak for myself. And I suppose people I watch work, it can be really hard to invest all day long in kids and do a really great job and then bring lesson plan books home and learn new curriculum and all these awesome responsibilities that teachers do really well. And then also expect them to advocate on the Hill or contacting legislatures and making a difference to help kind of inform policy. I mean, that's a really, really tall order. So sometimes it winds up that I think teachers and educators' voices are absent from conversations where decisions are being made about the work, about our calling without our voices there. And again, this all kind of ties in and to the book. But before we get off the topic of assessment, one of the things in the book that I really am proud of is I feel like I connected with 30 or more people and then also tapped into some personal experiences, but it's a book of stories. It's a really storied book that reads differently than most professional development books. So when you're reading Reclaiming Our Calling, you get to know these, I'll use the word characters, but you get to know these people, you know, students, educators over the course of the whole book, and they develop, and there's kind of almost a relationship and a vulnerability that is established. They're not isolated, but in all that, we wanted it to be really actionable so that we actually can start to do approach our work with balance and take back the practices that are slanted against what we think is best for kids. So little like try this things are sprinkled throughout. And with assessment, one of the things is, so if we have to do this assessment, whether it's directed by the district or a state assessment, you know, if there's a way we can make it more meaningful, like maybe on a district benchmark, then asking kids that after that test just to do a free response, you know, spend 1 minute telling me something that you want me to know about yourself, or what's a passion you have outside of school that a lot of people don't know about, just that little data point. And in that particular instance or strategy, I mean, think about how much more we would know our students and be able to personalize the learning and actually kind of build upon that relationship process to help them learn more and in a way that's meaningful to them over the course of the year. So I don't know if that gives you a flavor for like, how do we actually navigate this system in a way that works for us and also recharges our batteries and serves students. But that's kind of the approach really the whole book follows.
I like that. I like that a lot. That's good. I'm going to say that that's worth checking out. I'm going to be picking up my copy here and give it a read, because I think that can help all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I learned, you know, and these aren't, I mean, my jaw kind of dropped on some of the strategies from other people as they shared them. And as I kind of featured their voices and their thinking, it was just really humbling to have different people from all over the country. And I think even beyond just share their insights, because when we talk about reclaiming our calling, I mean, let's be honest, the exact reason and kind of your goals why you get up in the morning are going to be nuanced and even different than mine, which is exactly why it's so important to hear how you do what you do and why you do it and get a better understanding of that as we kind of approach this collective effort together, because we're actually more connected than any of us might imagine. And we're ultimately impacted by many of the same expectations, regardless of the state we live in.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I want to honor your time, and I know you don't have a ton of time with me today, and but I want to get to a couple of the questions that I ask most of my guests. And
yeah,
the first question I ask all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Okay, so just off the cuff, one that comes to mind above and beyond what we've already talked about is the concept of personalization. I feel like there's a chance that, you know, a lot of people are down with that. They're, you know, let's do it. Let's make it personal. But sometimes that comes off as, let's have machine learning take over. Let's sit kids in front of a computer that can kind of level for them. And I guess I just see an opportunity to really make things personal in a different way. And I'll go back to the book because that's how I approach my life and my work. When we start with relationships and then kind of get to the core or the moral foundation of the work, part of that becomes understanding and celebrating kids and our own identities, and then making sure the learning is relevant to them, and then getting to like the center. This is what I believe, you know, it starts with the relationships, but the destination is not relationships. Like when we're gone, we actually need our kids to be able to do and think differently because of our effort and relationship with them. So the goal, I call it transcendent learning, or also learning that lasts. So the biggest problem is how, like, or I'll just phrase it a little differently. One of the bigger challenges for us is, how do we personalize learning so that we can empower each and every learner that we serve to do learning that lasts, as opposed to that surface level stuff that they will not remember in a month or in several years. And let's be honest, in some cases, they won't remember next week.
I like that. How do we personalize learning in a way that each and every learner learns in a way that lasts?
Yep. And that's that's a great and lofty goal, but doing that is really hard work because it requires knowing the learner. I mean, that's like step number one. which requires giving teachers the time and support to know the learner, and piling on mandates and having them hyper-focus on things that they should not be hyper-focused on, like destructive testing practices as opposed to meaningful assessment. I mean, these are big, important things. And if we can kind of morph and you know, in the areas we have autonomy, we can do great good together as long as we're learning from one another and kind of sharing these ideas. We actually can make quite a bit of progress and empower ourselves to personalize learning in a way that helps us get closer to that goal of learning that lasts. And I think also just being realistic with ourselves and with our kids, like if something is to be learned for the test, I mean, I hate to say that, I'm just being honest. If it is, I think it's okay to say that and name that, like this is for the test. But then obviously our, you know, really gifted educators are going to have the conversation with kids and get, and when I say educator, I'm including teachers and principals and at every level, like how might we make this relevant to you so that supports you not only in the short term, but in the long term too, because we're here to serve you. And that might mean a spinoff or taking something deeper or letting the student kind of propose something and going down a different path of inquiry or a different project that's meaningful to them, and maybe even faltering and not coming up with a perfect solution, but just learning from the experience. But I don't, there's a space there for all of that to happen, but it takes courage and conversation and people really working together. And I think having a similar language to Brad, like just naming something, this is for learning that lasts. Here's the thing that always riles me up. I would call this another problem in education. So I'll go to a conference and we'll share, or I'll hear someone share a really cool idea that's making a difference for kids. And often, or people, it happens when they visit our school too, because we host tours and, you know, people are checking out the cool work our teachers are doing. And cool, I don't mean that in a trivial sense, but really important work and transformational work. But sometimes visiting educators will say, how does that impact test scores? And they're not even, I think a lot of times they'll verbalize this, they're not even asking for themselves. They're asking for when they go back and talk to their principal or administrator, because they're seeing and articulating the value. Like, I get why this supports or is conducive to learning that lasts. I get why that's best for kids, really, compared to what we're currently doing. But how am I going to sell or explain this to someone else who has a different hyper-focus on something? And I think that's problematic. At the very least, what if we change that line of questioning to maybe leading with a different question, like, wow, how is that? How does that help contribute to learning that lasts? And then maybe asking, following up with an achievement question, because that's not a bad question. Like asking about how it's going to impact achievement isn't bad. I'm not saying that. But if that's all we ever ask or lead with, it really is kind of a sad telling look at our values, because these are whole amazing people that are coming through our doors every single day that are counting on us to see their hearts, their minds, and their hopes, not just their potential test scores.
Yeah. Yeah, that is sad that they're seeing phenomenal stuff and the first thing they have to think about, you know, not is that part of it. But you know, it is the reality of what we do, because if you don't increase test scores, you don't have money. You know, I mean, unfortunately, the way things are tied right now, you have to have those things, right? Like you have to have the funding, and you can't do cool and innovative new things without the funding available. If you can't afford to hire teachers, you can't afford for your teachers to innovate, right? Like that's just the reality of it. So yeah, it's a sad reality for sure. But I think what you're circling around in my mind is sort of, we focus so much on the test and the system is the way it is, but if we're doing the right things in general, in my experience, the test will work itself out. You know, they'll do well on the test because we're teaching them learning that's going to last, and it is applicable on the test, even if it's not directly the words that are on the test, right?
Right. And and thanks for like the subtle kind of pushback, or just keeping it real, I guess I would call it. That's so important. So realistically, we do want kids to learn at a really high level, and that does translate to higher test scores, right? But if
well, assuming the test is accurate. But
yeah, that's a whole other discussion. But it kind of is what it is. But if every breath we take in our school is to raise a test score, we're going to need CPR, and actual learning and developing like a curiosity and a passion for learning is going to need CPR, because that's going to die. We have to have permission and champion conversation centered around, yes, let's help kids learn at a high level, and let's get to know their names and their families and their hopes and dreams, and not have to apologize for that. If somebody else walks in the room and sees that, we need people to recognize and value the fact that getting to know a student on a deeper level and developing that relationship is part of the process. It's not something I have to feel guilty about if someone walks in and sees me having an authentic conversation with a kid, because those are the kids that are gonna come back, and those are the things that they're never going to forget. And along the way, I'm going to hold myself accountable for helping him or her learn at a high level. It doesn't start with the accountability, but that is part of the process.
I like it. Well, I know we're running low on time. I normally would get to two more questions, but I know we're running out. So my second question is always, what is something you're doing you wish everybody would do? But I think your book is going to speak to the answer to that question. I think we've hit that one pretty well. So instead, I want to get to the more personal question, and I want to ask you, who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Oh man, Brad. So I've had many great teachers, but I'll just share a couple things that they did. And I will also say in the book, Reclaiming Our Calling, Mrs. McLean is one of the main people that you'll get to know really, really well. Incredible educator, and it will unpack why she was so impactful. And over the course of the story, you'll get to see some of her idiosyncrasies. So I'll throw that out there. But in addition to that, I also want to just say, like, when I was in second grade, I had Miss Nielsen at the time. And here's one thing I remember about her. Other than show and tell and her taking an interest in the Legos that I like to build, this will sound really maybe stupid, but I still remember it. You know, she would touch the back of her hand to my cheek every once in a while, and just in a caring, kind of in the moment way. Like, we'd be talking, and it's just like a, I don't know how you would describe it, motherly, but there was a human connection where just in that brief 1 second encounter, I knew that she cared about me and that she saw me, right? And that was so important. And I was actually just, the reason that's on my mind is I was in a classroom, and I forget the grade level, but I saw a teacher do that super briefly to a student. It was just it was very professional, but very vulnerable and caring. And the student, you could just tell that the kiddo was going to learn a zillion things over the course of the year because of that level of connection and care. But it triggered, I even mentioned it to the teacher. I said, you just gave me a flashback to my second grade year, and I'll never forget how Miss Nielsen connected with me from time to time in that manner. And then on the whole other end of the spectrum, in high school, I had a teacher named Mr. Galvin, and he just was his authentic self, a little bit zany, but every once in a while, he would get down on his hands and knees and kind of talk through the vent to a neighboring classroom in a weird voice. But those were the things, you know, if I'm being honest, I didn't wake up in the morning in high school super excited about high school math, and that's what he taught. But I think the relationship that he had with myself and my classmates kept us as dialed in as we could be. And sometimes it was just him having fun and letting his guard down. And the fact that I'm talking about that, you know, multiple decades later, those two individuals, it obviously left an impression.
Yeah. And I mean, again, like you said, going back to sort of what has been the theme of this whole thing is the importance of building those human connections, those human moments, that recognizing our students as people and our teachers as people and our administrators as people, and making those connections and that back to that idea that we are just all connected in so many ways. And I think that I think those all tie in very nicely together.
And as in your role as an instructional coach and in my role serving as a principal, because I've done, I mean, trust me, I've failed at this more than I've succeeded, you know, in full transparency. But when the relationship is not there and that kind of culture of trust, when I walk into a room, that's one thing. And we know how that goes. But when I'm working really hard to know a person and their family and a teacher's interests and kind of check back in out of genuine care on, you know, her husband's new job or whatever the case may be, and then circling back within that setting, you know, the risk taking and the hard work and the vulnerability and just coaching conversations, not just me coaching teachers, but them coaching me. I mean, that is an amazing thing because then I'm able to serve better. But absent a relationship, most often you won't have that growth and that learning. So again, it's not that relationships are the final destination, but boy, can they help us go further on behalf of our kids.
Relationships can help us go further on behalf of our kids, even if they aren't the final destination. I think that's a beautiful sentiment to wrap us up with here. We ran a little over the time.
It sounds even better when you say it. You have a great voice, Brad.
I switch it. My friends joke around when they started listening to the podcast. They're like, you know, you sound different. I go, this is the only way I know how to talk. But apparently when you put a mic in front of me, I switch into podcast voice.
That's great.
So, well, Brad, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. I felt we were all over the place in this chat. We were back and forth and I loved it. It was great. It was a good time. We may have to do a part two. We may have to do another one.
Yeah, I would love to anytime. And thanks for just the opportunity to have a free flowing conversation about things that we both care about and sharing a little bit about yourself too. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I love it. Before we go, how can my audience get a hold of you if they'd like to learn more?
Yeah, bradgustafson.com is my website. And there are some links to get to the new book, Reclaiming Our Calling, published by IM Press, George Kuros's team, George and Paige.
Perfect. I will have links to that as well as direct links to the book in the show notes. So you can always swipe over, swipe down and check those out as well on whatever podcast player you're in. And definitely check Brad out. And I know I'll be buying a copy of the book as well after this chat. I'm excited about it. So I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you very much.
Hey, this was fun. Thanks, Brad.
Brad, thank you so much for a wild and random chat. We bounced around a lot, but it was a lot of fun. To connect with Brad, find him on Twitter at GustafsonBrad. Also his website, bradgustafson.com, where you can find links to his blog as well as his book, Reclaiming Our Calling. Links to all of those also are in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you guys there. And that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or the feedback page from my website that gives you additional options for feedback. And you can find that at bradschreffler.com/feedback. And I look forward to meeting some of you at ISTE on Sunday, June 23rd. Until next week, think about how you can personalize learning in a way that will last. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.